KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? And you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that. But prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, making and marketing a four-hour movie in an age of multitasking and smash cutting. We talked to Laura Bickford, the Oscar-winning producer of Steven Soderbergh's new epic, Che. Plus, what's it like to be a woman in the testosterone-fueled world of the Hollywood paparazzi? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere. It's The Business from KCRW. Even 60 million copies of The Da Vinci Code worldwide couldn't save the job of Doubleday president Steve Rubin. Doubleday's parent company, Random House, underwent massive consolidation last week that included his axing as part of the overall pain being suffered by the book business. There were big layoffs at publishers Simon & Schuster and Thomas Nelson as well. Even celebrity rags are in trouble. Gossip magazines Life & Style and In Touch are lowering the number of weekly readers they claim to advertisers. It seems that stressed-out consumers are not looking for consolation in photos of Hollywood bikinis and Botox, rhinoplasty, and rehab. Conventional wisdom holds that, unlike paper, celluloid is recession-proof. But is it really? Last week, Viacom announced it will slash 850 jobs, or about 7% of its workforce, as well as suspend salary increases for senior management as part of a restructuring plan. Also part of the media company's attempt to slash spending, a write-down on some of its supposedly recession-proof entertainment assets to the tune of about $400 million. NBC Universal moved to cut 500 jobs, or 3% of its staff from every department, as part of an effort to trim $500 million from its budget. Universal Pictures alone will shed about 70 employees. The financial malaise has also torn the gloves off the long-simmering, I cannot believe there's still not a deal yet, talks between the Screen Actors Guild and the studios. Over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, both sides began PR campaigns over an upcoming strike authorization vote, with ballots now going out to SAG's 120,000 members. In their letter, SAG President Alan Rosenberg painted actors as, quote, victims of corporate greed, unquote, who, quote, didn't cause this turmoil. Hollywood studio CEOs quickly penned an open letter to the industry in the LA Times, accusing SAG of, quote, demanding that the entire industry literally throw out all of its hard work because it believes it deserves more than the 230,000 other working people in the business, end quote. The CEOs were referring to the deal signed by the other guilds and unions with the producers. Of course, actors have different needs than writers, directors, and stagehands. But actors, for their part, should not be deluded. With no clear vision of how or how much money is going to be made from digital technologies, and with the economy in the turlet, a strike is a very bad idea. Consider this. Most actors don't rely primarily on acting for their livelihoods, and they might be the most likely to vote for a strike. Normally, they'd have the least to lose. But during a strike, the already weak economy would suffer even more, meaning that the straight jobs those actors have been relying on might disappear as well. Remember, more Americans are collecting unemployment now than at any time in the last 26 years. And you, Norma Rae, might just be joining them. Finally, a rant on behalf of the entire editorial staff of The Business. Last week, Rich Radin, the director of the LA Film Festival, was forced to resign because of his $1,500 donation to California's Proposition 8 anti-gay marriage campaign. Radin, who's a Mormon, had been the head of the festival since 2000. After much protest and pressure, Film Independent, which stood by him initially, said it accepted Radin's resignation, quote, with great reluctance, unquote, last week. Personally, we think that Radin's support of the initiative was wrongheaded and donating to the campaign, given his job, was naive. But we also think that the real issue should be how his personal views have affected or didn't affect how he chose films for the festival. In fact, by all accounts, it's been the very model of inclusion and open-mindedness under his stewardship. Radin's censure feels an awful lot like we're headed back to a time in Hollywood none of us should want to revisit. It was called the blacklist. Let's not shame ourselves by creating a pink list to go with it. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, it's hard out there for a pap, especially when you're a woman. But next, making and marketing an OCD film in an ADD world. According to the Guinness Book of World Records, The Cure for Insomnia is the longest film ever at 5,220 minutes. That's 3 days and 15 hours of artist L.D. Groban reading his poem of the same name, spliced with occasional clips from heavy metal videos and porn films. The longest feature film intended for theatrical release that anyone's seen in its entirety is probably Little Dorrit, the 1988 adaptation of the Charles Dickens novel starring Derek Jacobi. The film lasts 360 minutes and was released in two separate parts of approximately 3 hours each. Now, the decision to make a movie of that length is as much financial as artistic. Little Dorrit made very little money, even though it was nominated for two Oscars, and its length was certainly part of the reason why. Especially in this age of multitasking and smash-cutting, why would anyone make a four-hour, 18-minute film, and one largely in Spanish at that? But that's what Steven Soderbergh has done with his biopic of the revolutionary hero and T-shirt icon, Che Guevara, with Benicio del Toro in the title role.
Major Ernesto Che Guevara.
He is a Marxist, a soldier, a physician, and the power behind Fidel Castro.
What is the most important quality for a revolutionary to possess?
El amor.
Love.
Love.
Love of humanity, of justice and truth. A real revolutionary goes where he is needed.
¡Asesino! ¡Asesino!
Fusilamientos, sí, hemos fusilado.
Laura Bickford is one of the producers of Che. Laura Bickford, welcome to the business.
Thanks, Claude.
Was this planned always as a four-hour, two-part film?
No. We started off planning one film in English. Then we were two movies in English, and then we were two movies in Spanish. And that's been an interesting process. But the
let's catch people up here. So this is now a four-hour, two-part movie, half of which is in English and half of which is in Spanish?
It's all in Spanish, but there's an English voiceover in part one.
Okay. How does the studio react to this, shall we say, evolution in terms of size and scope?
They decided not to finance it.
Take me to that meeting.
Well, early on, in terms of the development process, Steven and Benicio and I decided to finance the development ourselves. So Steven and Benicio and myself, to a lesser extent, were paying for all of our research trips around the world and were paying for the screenplay. So because we knew that we needed to own our own material, so we had the freedom that whoever paid for the script couldn't dictate how it should be financed or what we should be doing.
So tell me about the meeting where you say, oh, by the way, it's going to be 4 hours and it's going to be in Spanish.
Well, it didn't quite happen like in one meeting. We always knew that we could never do the entire life of Che Guevara, and that we had the idea that we wanted to take one specific part of his life and try and do it in depth to avoid being sort of superficial. And we felt that everybody knew that he fought in the Cuban Revolution, but, you know, where did he go and what happened after he was on a poster on everybody's walls in the 60s? Or, you know, where what happened and how was he killed and why? And that all took place in Bolivia. So originally we decided to just do what is now part two, which was the Bolivian story. But we realized we couldn't just do Bolivia. We couldn't just do the end of Che's life without you understanding other things about him. And so we decided to film Che going to New York to speak to the United Nations in 1964. And it was sort of his rock star moment where he was extremely famous and he's speaking and he's to the United Nations and he's going to a sort of radical chic cocktail party and he's at the height of his fame. So we came up with the idea of doing a piece of the Cuban Revolution, a piece of Mexico City where Fidel and Che first meet, Che in New York, and then the Bolivian story. And we tried to intercut them in one movie like we did in Traffic. And it just got so unwieldy that Steven decided to make two films in a more linear fashion.
I understand why you did what you did. I'm interested in what their reaction was when you told them you were going to do what you did.
So we started with one movie in English, and everybody was very interested in paying for it at the studio level and distributing it. When we went to two movies in English, they were you know, thinking about it. When we then told them it was two movies in Spanish, they were not interested in distributing it or pre-buying it. And it's interesting because it's for a very specific reason. People seem to think that perhaps it's political because it's Che Guevara, and that was not it at all. It's that all the studios have put deals for pay television, which is in English language. And if it's not in English, they get nowhere near as much money for any foreign language movie. So it was a purely financial decision.
So when you say a put deal, meaning they have an arrangement with pay cable companies, mm-hmm. and, you know, Showtime or whatever the equivalent is overseas, and if they give them something other than something in English, they don't want it.
They don't want it.
Uh-huh. So you decide to make this movie in Spanish, 4 hours long. What do you give up?
We gave up the opportunity to have the U.S. distributors participate as a financier up front.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money.
It was a lot of money, yeah. But we made up that gap by qualifying as a Spanish film in Spain and qualifying for Spanish television subsidies. So we had our production funding for the two movies.
So it costs what it costs, regardless if it was in English or Spanish, or did you have to make
costs
a cheaper movie?
Costs whether it was in English or Spanish. Mm-hmm. But it was how to get all of that production funding without any money from the U.S., because usually the U.S. is a huge chunk of change. We always assumed that the major distributors would buy it for the U.S. once we went to Cannes. And we did finish in time for Cannes, and we premiered at Cannes, and we had a lot of buzz before Cannes. But a lot of distributors shut down right before Cannes. Picture House, Warner Independent, Vantage, a lot of the distributors for this movie disappeared right before Cannes. So I do think the economic climate and crisis certainly affected us on the U.S. sale of this movie.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the marketing of this movie as you get ready to release it. It's a four-hour back-to-back extravaganza, at least initially. If you happen to be listening to us in Los Angeles or New York, you have a chance at seeing all 4 hours of it. Bring some canned goods or maybe a tamale.
There's an intermission.
Okay.
It's two-hour movies. And we're showing it for a week in L.A. and New York with a half-hour intermission. There's no credits. We've gotten special waivers that we don't have to add another 10 minutes of credits for the long version. There's a special overture that Steven's done at the opening of each film, and we give you a program that has all the credits listed in beautiful Mary Ellen Mark photographs from the set. So we're really excited about the event. I think our goal is to let people see the film in different ways, the way they want to see it. After New York and LA's 1 week, what we call roadshow event, January 9th, it opens as two separate movies in 30 cities where we will show part one, you know, 2, 4, 6, and 8, and part two at 10. And we'll do that for a couple of weeks, and then they'll probably switch it around. In addition, we're doing something pretty radical, which is we are going to VOD, which is video on demand, and pay-per-view during the first run window. So I think on January 21st, for a premium, you can watch it on pay-per-view or VOD.
Would it have been easier to just do this like Lord of the Rings? Make three movies.
Mm-hmm.
Make however many you need to make. Why do it all in one go? Is it because it's just not possible otherwise? Or
it would not have been possible. I mean, we basically raised enough money for one film and made two. We made the shortest film we could about Che Guevara. We really could have made 10 hours. And, you know, the decision to do it in Spanish, while it made it harder and certainly has affected us in terms of the U.S. market, it has really helped us in the foreign markets because of the authenticity of the language. We're being distributed by Warner Brothers in France, by Fox in Spain, and it's only in the U.S. that we are now with a smaller independent distributor, and that is a really exciting opportunity. I mean, we're now trying new models for distribution that, you know, maybe in 5 years will be how everyone's doing it anyway.
If you're just joining us, at 4 hours and 18 minutes long, Steven Soderbergh's new epic about revolutionary hero Che Guevara faces tall marketing challenges in our short attention span world. The filmmaker and producers are counting on the fact that all the people who wear Che's likeness on their T-shirts will show up, despite the length. And they're hoping that Benicio del Toro will be nominated for an Oscar to help sell some tickets. Laura Bickford is one of the producers of Che.
I just cannot imagine that he won't be nominated. It's sort of a jinx to talk about it, but it's a hard road to be on a Oscar campaign with limited resources, you know, the studios tend to spend about 15 to 20 million per film on the Oscar campaign, and we're, you know, we have a much lower budget, around $1 million, to do all of our marketing. So we are just, you know, counting on word of mouth and people really responding to his performance and seeing the film, and I hope.
So the marketing plan really is to get it nominated? Is that it?
Well, that's always a marketing plan for every film that's not Batman, you hope. But I think, you know, if you read all of the Oscar Watch stuff right now, he's certainly in the running. I mean, who knows? But, you know, one doesn't make films to get awards. One makes films because they have something to say that they think are going to be successfully heard and enjoyed.
Right, but I'm interested in how you're selling it. And what I'm hearing you say is that the only way you can really sell this, given your limited resources, is to get an Oscar.
Another really important part of the marketing plan is this 4.5-hour, you know, 1-week event that will be happening only in New York and L.A. When we've had screenings, we've invited people to see part one and said, if you want to stay for part two, that's fine. Or if not, you know, we understand you can see part two at another time. Nobody ever leaves. I mean, you know, out of 400 people, maybe one or two people leave because they didn't plan to stay. So what's hard about 4.5-hour version is getting people into the theater because, you know, even my parents were like, 4.5 hours? Can I see two and two? But once they're there, it goes pretty fast and they don't want to leave.
So, but if you think your parents might even be reluctant, how do you convince, you know, the rank and file?
Well, I mean, that's what we're saying. We're opening it in two parts in January for people who just don't want to see 4.5 hours in the cinema. But there's a huge amount of people who do. I mean, this is, you know, like the Lawrence of Arabia event. This is, you know, Stephen talks about he remembers being desperate to come to the Ziegfeld in New York and see Lawrence of Arabia for 4 hours in theater. And Reds was as long with an intermission. There's a lot of people who are excited about coming to the 4.5-hour version, which is the 4 hours with a half-hour intermission. But, I mean, not everybody, so we understand that.
What are the conversations like with big theater chains, like, you know, the AMCs, the Cinemarks of the world? These are half the screens in America that are controlled by these mega conglomerate companies that are in the business, really, of selling lots of popcorn and turning over audiences one after the other after the other. There's a certain almost impossibility that they would ever agree to this, right? I mean, did you talk to them at all? What did they say?
We're doing the Ziegfeld and the Landmark in New York and L.A., and they're going to sell a lot of popcorn at the intermission and before and after.
But, I mean, when you sit down and talk to exhibitors, what are the conversations like? These bigger companies, I'm saying.
Well, you'd have to ask IFC a little more specifically about that. But as I said, when you're doing a movie that's going to go into up to 300 screens rather than 3,000 screens, it's a different conversation. I mean, it's good for everybody to have VOD that fuels people going to the theater. It's good to have the roadshow that fuels people to go to see it in two parts who don't want to see it in one part. But there are plenty of people that do want to see it, both movies together at the same time, the way we screened at the Cannes Film Festival, the way we screened at the London Film Festival, the way we screened in New York, Toronto festivals. Those audiences have responded incredibly well.
Well, we got to leave it there. Laura Bickford is the Academy Award-nominated producer of the critically acclaimed movie Traffic. Her latest film is Che, directed by Steven Soderbergh and starring Benicio del Toro. Benny the Bull, one of my favorites. She joined us at our studios here in Santa Monica. Laura, thanks for being on the Business.
Thanks, Claude.
A postscript. In an irony that Che himself would appreciate, Tiny IFC Films has had to partner with corporate behemoth Blockbuster to sponsor screeners for critics and Academy members, and they had to make a deal with bourgeois apparel company G-Star to sponsor the premiere at the New York Film Festival. You have to wonder if Che might have preferred a shorter film, a studio release, and a big marketing budget to get his message out to the masses. Coming up after a short break, it's hard out there for a pap, especially when you're a woman. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Federico Fellini's 1960 film La Dolce Vita introduced us to the term paparazzi. Legend has it that the name of the photographer character, Paparazzo, was actually a distortion of an Italian word for a kind of mosquito. Of course, Hollywood has taken what was a rather quaint concept and run with it. Now, when we say paparazzi, we're not talking about photographers who take shots of celebrities at red carpet events or fashion shows. Those are usually the invited press. The real paparazzi hunt down celebs wherever and whenever they can. Not surprisingly, they're almost all men. Su Yoon has the story.
There's a small crowd of photographers outside the Hollywood home of MTV reality star Lauren Conrad.
She just walked in. From what car?
That's Jennifer Buell, an accountant turned CNN producer and, for the last 2 years, a paparazza. Tall and girl next door attractive in her purpley pink dress, she stands out amongst the baggy jeans and dark hoodies of the male paparazzi. If not for her camera, she would be just any other 30-something. So, how did a nice girl like Jennifer get into a dirty business like chasing celebrities around L.A.?
One day I was just having a coffee after work, and all of a sudden about 8 SUVs blacked out, like pulled up, screeched, and everybody got out of the car with cameras, and I was like, what is going on? And I'd been in L.A. over a year and had never even seen a paparazzi or a celebrity. And I walked over, and it was Paris and Nikki Hilton shopping.
Nikki, let's see your signature smile. Your signature smile.
And I started talking to one of the paparazzi, and after about 5 minutes, I was like, you know what? I've been a photographer my whole life as a hobby, and I drive really fast, so what else do I need to know?
What she didn't know was, like most paparazzi, Jennifer's car would become her second home. Being a paparazzo, or a pap as they're called, is like being a low-rent gumshoe staking out an unfaithful husband. And it's just about as glamorous. You sit in a car full of fast food wrappers and empty coffee cups and wait. And if you're scared you're going to miss your shot, you'll resort to doing a lot more than that in your car. I'll let a pap named Eric explain.
Guys pee in a cup usually. They just, you know, lean over and they just pee in a cup. But I don't know how girls do it, so I asked this chick, I'm like, how do you pee in the car? And she's like, she never talked to me again.
Jennifer, how do you go to the bathroom when you're like sitting on a house like you are for a long time today? What do you do as a woman?
I rarely pee in my car. I mean, there have been times and I have managed, but it's very uncomfortable for a woman.
I can't even begin to imagine how one would do that.
I don't use a bottle. I would use a full cup, but it's still not easy.
Another thing that's not easy is actually finding the stars to photograph them. Doorstepping or sitting on a house means a stakeout. And one of the main places to stake out celebrities is outside their homes, if you can find them.
I bought a star map when I first started. I'm like, oh, wow, great. I've got a star map. I've got all these new addresses. And so when I showed it to one of the paps, he was like laughing at me because, no, I think they might have had one address right. They're a bunch of baloney.
These days, anyone with a cell phone camera fancies themselves paparazzi. You can usually find those amateurs outside trendy nightclubs, hoping for an easy payday. But the pros generally find the actual lair of their prey by following them home. And there's yet another way to figure out where they're going to be, from the stars themselves. Paparazzi are often called parasites, but the truth is, it's a symbiotic relationship.
That's how they become known. That's how they get publicity. I mean, probably almost any major celebrity who's famous right now has at one point in time done setup jobs. And they might not have orchestrated those with a particular paparazzi, but their agent would have called the magazines, who would have then called the photographers, and we would have met them at a store or restaurant.
Setup or not, when celebrities make themselves accessible, the paparazzi say they're giving it up. In fact, there's a lot of sex in pap lingo. Hosing means to take a picture out in the open. A gangbang is a mass of paps fighting for a shot. You don't have to hear much more to figure out pretty quickly that this is a man's world. Frank Griffin is a veteran photographer and co-owner of the Bauer Griffin Photo Agency. Do you think if women paparazzi are hazed or treated differently by their male colleagues?
I think it's going to happen, but I think that happens to the weak and infirm anyway, or the ones who are seen as weak and infirm. And I think it's the kind of job where there's a lot of testosterone going on. I mean, you come to our office at Friday afternoon when the week's finished and everyone is popping up the feathers, and it's like a testosterone bath, you know.
But is the weaker sex actually at a disadvantage?
It is fairly rough and tumble, in as much as you have a lot of weight to carry, you're shoulder to shoulder or elbow to elbow with other photographers, which is where the biggest threat comes in terms of physical threat. You have to be able to carry 20 or 30 pounds of equipment around your neck, wield that equipment, shoot well, and still be, you know, in the middle of a crush sometimes.
Guys,
gotta walk, guys.
No, come on. I'm not gonna push any further. I'm not gonna do any further. Get out of the way.
It was disgusting. One day on Brittany, I got some horrible treatment, yelled at, just called names, slurred, just for no reason at all.
What kind of name?
Just, you know, like, you f***ing bitch, don't cross the street in front of me or something like that. And then when the shooting was going down, I looked at this guy. I was like, what was that about? What do you do? And then he and all his friends called my agency. And I started getting calls from my boss and my photo editor and all this. Like, you need to leave Brittany. Everybody says you're making Brittany difficult. And they're not going to let our company get shots on Brittany if you don't leave. And maybe they just needed to see me cry, which I'm fine with.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I was bawling that day. Like, is this what you want? You want me to cry? Fine.
But there are upsides to being a woman, especially if you're all dolled up.
A French girl that moved away would tell me, you need to dress nicely because there's a lot of times you need to go in places. And as a female, you have the ability to go in places as just a regular person or a patron. But when you're sitting in your car for 8 hours a day, too, you want to be comfortable and, you know, wear flip-flops and not fancy clothes, because it's uncomfortable to sit in your car all day in that kind of outfit.
There must be, I'm sure, situations where a female photographer will gain advantage by virtue of the fact that she's female. She may be able to charm, schmooze, or persuade a male security guard, for example, to gain access.
But overall, it's not easy for female paparazzi. Which begs the question, given the treatment and the other drawbacks, why would a woman want this job? The big money, right? Well, despite what you might have heard, the reality is that no one retires off one shot. Jennifer Buell and her then-partner got great photos of teen star Vanessa Hutchins a few months ago. But after the agency took its 40% cut, they each only made about $1,500. At the end of the day, to be a pap, male or female, you've got to really love the hunt, the chase, the adrenaline. I caught up with some male photographers outside a Hollywood hotel where Brad Pitt's parents were supposedly staying. Here's Jeff.
I mean, this isn't a job that, you know, most people would even want to be doing. You know, a lot of waiting and doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And then if you're on a story and you're waiting for them to come out, there's a lot of jockeying for position. Oh,
I'm going with Jeff.
Move it over.
Okay. The bomber guy?
Yeah, they must have come out the front.
Yeah. Well, good luck.
On the chase for that perfect picture of Brangelina, this is Sue Yoon for The Business.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.